Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, in a few minutes, we'll speak with an author of a new book about what authoritarian male rulers all have in common. The author says there's a link between self-professed strongmen like Vladimir Putin and Mussolini and Donald Trump. We'll talk about what they have in common and the tools they use to achieve and hold power in just a moment. But first, one listener comment about yesterday's program, and like you to fact check this computer or this comment. Those of you near your computers, please listen closely to this. The listener comment came in after yesterday's program. Please listen closely and tell me what this listener gets right and what this listener gets wrong.
Hey, yeah, this is Steve Stewart, St. Pete Beach, Florida. Just call in, listen a little bit of your show, and got some thoughts. I am a Trump supporter. I did vote for him. I think the election was, to some degree, a fraud, but it's over. I do have issues with people calling him a Nazi. I've had customers who actually lived through that, and I've heard the personal stories from them, and they do not correlate to anything that's happened today. No one seems to worry about the money that was spent on the Russian hoax. No one seems to worry about Hunter Biden. No one seems to worry about Joe accepting money from China. No one seems to worry about anything that Biden has done. And it's disappointing to see that in this country that the media can manipulate and attack someone daily. No mentions of his a Nobel Peace Prize nominations. None of the networks carried it, I think, other than Fox. But I do believe this country is in trouble. I really don't have any faith in any elections going forward. As soon as the mail-in ballots became an issue for the Democrats, there was no way to determine who it was, when it was, and how it was sent. And there have been cases where fraud has occurred.
All right. Well, there you go. That was a listener comment that came in after yesterday's program. And just curious, those of you near your computers who have the ability to fact check, what would you say about that caller's claims that Joe Biden accepted money from China? There's no way to determine who sends in a mail-in ballot, that Trump's Nobel Peace Prize nomination was not mentioned by the mainstream media at all. It was only covered by Fox. What do you think about those claims? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address, dj@wmnf.org. And let's just fact check that listener for a moment before we hear from our guest, who's coming on in just a few minutes. But if you want to give me your thoughts about what that caller said, I'm sure a lot of people hold those views. I can say one thing for sure, and that is that in his financial disclosure forms, there's no evidence that Joe Biden accepted any money from China. It just doesn't show up. And the fact checkers have looked at this, and it doesn't exist. But what do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. We're going to hear our guest in just a few minutes. But I'm sure that there are a lot of people out there who agree with that caller. And I'm just hoping that if you're near your computer, you can fact check for a little bit. He complained about the money spent investigating the Russian hoax. Would you have, if you were in Congress, would you have wanted an investigation about whether or not President Trump called Ukraine and suggested that if they do the right thing, that he would send them the kind of military aid that they wanted? Would that be something that you would want investigated? And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663, email address dj@wmnf.org. Bill Grace is our phone producer today, and let's see if we get some calls on this before we move on here. 813-239-9663. Doug writes this from Clearwater. A lot of stuff there, Rob, from that caller. I'm tired of having been sitting on the edge of my seat waiting for the concession speech. Just kidding, writes Doug. And he goes on to say, no Nobel Prize because there is not peace in the Middle East yet, writes Doug. Yeah, the Nobel Prize nomination is very interesting. And if those of you who have a computer who can fact check that, take a look at how President Trump was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. You might find that there are sites beyond Fox News that have covered that story. Let's go to Patty in Sarasota. Patty, what would you like to comment about that caller said?
Wow, I'm first in line.
Well, you are first in line.
I thought, Rob, I would ask you because I wanted to know what you knew about whatever this Hunter Biden money from China, Joe Biden involved, blah, 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 because I know you just said there's no evidence, but what... You know, I'm so confused. Sometimes I hear these bits and pieces because I cruise all over the news and everything. What is the accusation is that Biden knew his son did something, I don't know, underhanded, illegal, something with China. Is that what it is? And that is a compromise to the country? Is that what is being said? Because I'm confused. I thought you would know exactly what the...
Well, Patty, I was kind of hoping to fact-check that caller. Let me tell you this. There are some really great articles that look at the Hunter Biden story. And the Wall Street Journal wrote a great article about it. Vanity Fair has another good article. If you email me, it's really simple. If you've got a computer, it's really simple to find these articles that go in-depth, that kind of explode this myth that somehow Joe Biden made money from a Hunter Biden deal in China. I'm not going to go into it right now because I've got a guest coming on in 2 minutes. but if you email me, rob@wmnf.org, I'll send you some really good articles. And they're easy to find. If you have a computer, this stuff is all knowable. It's all researchable. And it's all easy to find. And I don't mean to not want to talk about Hunter Biden, but the fact checkers have been on this. And the other place to look at are the fact check websites, PolitiFact and the Washington Post fact check sites. They've all looked at it too. Let's go to John in Port Richey. John, what would you like to say about the caller?
Well, I think Amy Goodman mentioned the nomination for Trump's Nobel Peace Prize.
She did, yes.
And that's, you know, here on this Sebastian liberal radio station, apparently. So you guys covered that just like Fox News. So that discounts that right there. I don't know about the mainstream media because I don't listen to that. Going back to voter fraud, sure, there's voter fraud. I won't get into that. But go back and look at what I think it was South Carolina in 2016 where the election was thrown out because the Republican was going in and filling out the ballot. So once again, that caller always implies that the voter fraud is on the Democratic side and not even the Republican side. So just a few points there. And I could even go into the Heritage Foundation, but I don't want to take up the time. Thanks.
All right, John. Thanks a lot. I mean, one of the things about the Nobel Peace Prize is that there is a committee in Norway that nominates people to be possible Nobel Peace Prize winners that year. And lots of people get nominated. And the committee is very diverse. It has conservatives on it and has liberals and progressives. And this year, President Trump was nominated, as were dozens, if not hundreds of other people of all political spectrums, across the political spectrum. So I think that's, I wish we had a listener who had a computer who is calling us up right now. I'm going to take a break and we're going to talk with our guest in just a moment. This is 88.5 FM WMNF in Tampa.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me the truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pick and
Music from John Lennon here on 88.5 FM. Well, President Trump and his allies, including most of the top elected Republican officials here in Florida, are refusing to concede that Democrat Joe Biden won the presidential election. The president is challenging some results in courts, but so far those courts have dismissed his claims that there has been widespread voter fraud. President Trump has already told advisors that he's thinking about running again for president in the year 2024. That's according to two sources who spoke with Axios. President Trump's determination to cling to power, no matter what, has brought comparisons to strongmen in other countries, both currently and in recent history. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is an internationally known historian and professor at New York University, and she's written a new book that describes what strongmen leaders all have in common. The book is Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present, and she's on the phone with us. Ruth, welcome to WMNF. It's so great to have you here.
Thank you.
What's the definition of a strongman, and are they always men?
I use the term to refer to a type of authoritarian leader who, asserts his executive power, damages or destroys, especially in the 20th century, destroys democracy, so domesticates the judiciary, the press, and also uses a kind of macho bluster and kind of virility to threaten, to charm, to seduce, and kind of wraps the state around his private financial needs and makes his personality have an outside influence on the formulation, implementation of national policy.
And would it be fair to say that President Trump is included in this club, so to speak?
Yeah, what the book does is I felt it was time to go look at a century of this authoritarian rule and how it's changed. So in the 20th century, you had these one-party states, dictatorships, and today things work differently. You have people who come to office by elections, and they manipulate elections to stay there. So in terms of his temperament and in terms of his aspirations, I see Trump as a strongman, and he's part of this continuum of leaders who would like to, if they had their druthers, they would stay in office indefinitely. And in the past, in the 20th century, they often did.
So let's talk about some of the other names that are on the list. The title of the book is Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. So you're including Benito Mussolini from Italy in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. Who else is on your list?
So the book is divided into three historical periods. So you have the fascist period, and there I have Mussolini and Hitler and Franco. And then I have the age of military coups, because many strongmen came to office via coup. So I have Mobutu in the Congo, Pinochet, and Gaddafi in Libya. Gaddafi ruled for 42 years. And then you have the age of what I call new authoritarians. And this starts with the end of the Cold War, when U.S.-backed coups became, or Soviet-backed coups became, less common. And there you have somebody, you have the evolution of men like Berlusconi in Italy, who is, there's many analogies with Trump. He never destroyed democracy, but he kind of wrapped it around his finger, both in being able to pass laws that were tailored to his personal judicial problems and financial problems. And so then you get to the age of the present, and I have Putin, I have Erdogan in Turkey, Bolsonaro, and I look at how our own Trump fits in or does not fit into this history.
Well, you talk about the four tools that are used by strongmen across the last 100-year period, and you boil it down to this: propaganda, virility, some call it hypermasculinity, corruption, and violence. Let's talk about some of the previous cases in history. How did they use propaganda? And talk about how President Trump is using propaganda.
One of the most fascinating parts of the research was the realization that although the outcomes are different than certainly in the fascist era, but the rules, for example, of personality cults are a center of authoritarian propaganda. All strongman rulers have personality cults. And the rules of those stayed the same. So the leader has to be a man of the people, and so the successful strongman is always someone who's who knows how to communicate very effectively. He has a direct communications channel with the people, and so Mussolini had newsreels, and Hitler used radio very effectively, and Trump and Bolsonaro used Twitter, right? So they're men of the people, relatable, but they're also men above all other men. And so one of the things that recurs is this idea that the strongman is ruling with divine benediction, and they have alliances with religious institutions. So in our case, evangelical Christians and Orthodox Jews believe that Trump has been sent into office to save the nation. And so this is a very old theme. And from this, they get this kind of, they base their authority on both popular will and this kind of higher power that makes them special.
The second tool that they use is virility. I know Valerie Sperling, in a book that she wrote about Putin, talks about hypermasculinity. How do these previous rulers and President Trump use this image of virility? How do they project it, and how do they use it to hold power?
Yeah, that's a great book that you mentioned. And so what I did is that there are many studies by historians and political scientists that talk about corruption and propaganda and forms of governance. But I wanted to take virility seriously, hypermasculinity seriously, because when we see, you know, Mussolini stripping his shirt off and Putin is the leader who continues that, he pictures himself without a shirt fishing or riding a horse, and this kind of virility as a tool of political legitimacy. And so the way that they use their bodies, now Trump doesn't strip his shirt off, he borrows other men's bodies. So he tweeted a picture of himself from his personal account, wasn't even a retweet, of his face photoshopped onto Sylvester Stallone's body from Rocky, because this is the image of this kind of macho fighter that he wants to convey. And it's very effective for people. And so we can think about very recently the whole saga of how Trump triumphed over COVID. And he came out of the hospital, and he bounded up the stairs of the White House, and he stood on the balcony, and so people were saying, oh, he's like Mussolini. But what he was doing was reassuring his followers that he was their rock, that nothing could, so the illnesses that would fell mortal, regular men cannot affect him. And he said, I feel so powerful, right? So instead of dismissing this or laughing at it, I take it very seriously, because both in terms of their charm and in terms of the way they threaten people, their machismo is extremely important.
Well, our guest is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's an historian at New York University, and her book, brand new, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. And you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Corruption. President Trump famously promised to drain the swamp. How do these strong men use corruption? How does it arrive, or what role does it play in their office?
The first person who promised to drain the swamps with that literal expression was Mussolini, who did actually drain swamps. But also promised to clean up corruption and clean up the mafia, and instead fascism came in and adopted mafia tactics. And corruption, what I do in the book is I not only look at financial corruption, and you have the extremes of this kleptocracies of Mobutu, and Putin today, as many people, analysts, consider his government to be a kleptocracy, where the assets are plundered. There are tens of thousands of businesses that have been seized, and Erdogan in Turkey has done the same thing. But it's also a kind of moral corruption. How do they get people to work for them and do their bidding? So in the case of Trump, I really see him in this regard. His goals have been different goals than past presidents. And one of his goals has been to turn public office into a machine to make money for the ailing Trump organization. And until coronavirus shut down his travels, he spent one out of every 3 days for the first 3 years of his presidency, he spent one out of every 3 days at a Trump-branded property. So when people say, oh, he's so lazy, he just likes to golf, well, he does like to golf, but when he's golfing, he's he's promoting a Trump property, and he's using public office to for private benefit. And so that's an example of corruption, as well as the violation of the Hatch Act and any number of other ethical violations that his administration perpetrates every day.
And the other tool, the fourth tool, is violence. Let's talk about Mussolini and Hitler and their rise to power. How did they use violence? And what violence do you attribute to Trump?
So this was a one of the more unpleasant chapters to write, and things have changed, and so every chapter goes over a century. And so the reader can see what has remained the same and what has changed. So, of course, the fascist violence was a central political mechanism, culminating in genocides in Libya, in Mussolini's case, and the Holocaust, in Hitler's case. And you see that today, in the 21st century, things work differently, where there's less genocide, there's less mass public violence, there's more targeted violence, like Putin's signature is poisoning. So I look at what was the signature violence of each of these people. Whereas Erdogan engages in mass detention. And then you have somebody like Orban in Hungary, who has domesticated the country and now rules by decree, who's used very little physical violence. Things change, and in the case of Trump, there's incitements to violence. There's indirect and there's indirect kind of violence against African Americans through policing, through detention. There's mass detention, which didn't start with Trump. It started certainly with Bush and Obama, but has been increased. So things work differently today, but the inclusion of certain groups and the exclusion of others remains a constant.
We're talking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat about her brand new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and this is WMNF in Tampa. You say that all strong men promise a perfect future, a glowing future that replaces a bleak present. And I just want to play just a few seconds of President Trump's inauguration speech. This is what President Trump said when he was inaugurated in 2017.
An education system flush with cash, but which leaves our young and beautiful students deprived of all knowledge. And the crime and the gangs and the drugs that have stolen too many lives and robbed our country of so much unrealized potential. This American carnage stops right here and stops right now.
President Trump speaking at his inauguration in 2017. So is that typically how strong men paint the beginning of their term in office or their beginning of their reign in power?
That's a great question, because not only strongmen engage in crisis politics where they have to present the present as a situation of crisis, of depression, the country's humiliated by foreign powers that exploit it. And it was very interesting to see that, even Trump, America's a superpower, but even Trump engaged in this idea that we're poor America being exploited, and so he was going to do America first. But this was very key, this inauguration speech, because then he comes in and he's going to save America. So they have to present the present as a terrible place in order to have this glowing future. But there's another dimension of this, there's a chapter in the book called The Myth of National Greatness where I spell this out. It's not just that you make the nation great, you make it great again. And that's very important. And again, I was amazed at how Trump's rhetoric echoes a century of authoritarian, discourse, because Mussolini had the Roman Empire, so making Italy great again. Erdogan talks about the Ottoman Empire. Putin talks, about Imperial Russia and the Russian Empire. In Trump's case, it's more of a kind of vague time when people of color knew their place, when there wasn't all this, there wasn't same-sex marriage, and a kind of, he appeals to people who see change as a source of anxiety. So great again, we don't have a specific empire to refer to, but the psychological appeal is the same.
You point out that strong men want to purify a country of certain groups, and depending on what era, it's a different group, or depending on what country it is, it's a different group. But they all have that in common, that they want to just purify the country of certain groups.
Yeah, they do. And there's similar language that gets used. And I want to emphasize here that because I wanted to look at the whole arc of depleting or destroying a democracy, so I didn't examine communist rulers because most of them inherit a system that was already autocratic. So I'm dealing mostly with right-wing authoritarians, except I have Gaddafi for reasons the reader will see. And the rhetoric of kind of looking at the left as a kind of, you know, we're going to save civilization from leftist barbarism. We're going to protect the country through the erection of walls from foreigners coming over the border. All of this rhetoric of national purity and making certain groups into enemies continues. And on that note, I should say that the groups that are often singled out, besides religious minorities or ethnic groups, are groups who can do some harm to the strongman, such as prosecutors or journalists. And these groups get discredited very, very early on because if they uncover secrets that could pose a problem for the leader, he needs them to be already discredited. And Trump actually said this in an interview to Leslie Stahl, that he's just trying to make, he used the word discredit. So this is an old playbook that he uses, and that's why with my history of studying fascism, when I saw Trump begin to do all of these things, I began to think about him. Well, this isn't really a leader who's using a democratic frame of reference. He's using other methods and other goals, and from there was born the idea to look back at a century of authoritarian rule and see, you know, where do we fit in?
I find it interesting, too, that you point out in your book, and I hadn't thought about this before, that that oftentimes these strongmen come in following a period of gain for women, for labor, for racial minorities. The gains are made, and then the strongmen come in to try to undermine those gains.
Yeah, and this is one of the fundamental recurrences I found. And this was true, of course, in America as well. And I think that for me, I've always been a historian of Europe and then also a global historian because I work on empire, but I'm not trained in American history. And my parents are immigrants. They're not. My mother's from Scotland and my father's born in Jerusalem. So I learned American history, but not a specialist in it. And I think that's been a bonus for me to look at this history, this global history, and then turn this lens on America to see the same things going on. And the outcome is always different because each country has its own national history, its own situation. But the tools of rule and the aspirations are often the same.
You're an expert on the history of fascism in Italy. So let me ask you this. A lot of people are confused. They say, well, Mussolini, he was a socialist when he started out, or Adolf Hitler, he called his movement national socialism. So when we talk about these kinds of fascism, we're not talking about right-wing movements. That's what the critics say. The critics say, well, these are socialists. So therefore, these folks were on the left, and that's an example why we shouldn't trust the left. You know the history of Mussolini, and you've studied the history of Hitler's rise. When you hear, and I'm sure you've heard this before, a lot of people are confused. What do you know? What can you say?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that because it is frustrating to me, and listeners should know that this isn't only something that conservative and right-wing people are saying in America, it's become a talking point of the global right. Bolsonaro in Brazil and his officials also talk about fascism having been left-wing. So they're exploiting, as you said, this fundamental ambiguity in the beginnings of fascism, in the origin of fascism. Mussolini had been a socialist, but he got kicked out of the Socialist Party in 1914. And then he integrated certain things from socialism, like the idea of revolution. But there was no doubt as to who his targets was. And in fact, in both Italy and Germany, the earliest and the most consistent targets of the fascists were leftists. Not just communists, but socialists, social democrats, the center-left people. These were the earliest and most consistent targets. And so you have to ask why people are saying that fascist violence is left and using it as a way of trying to discredit the left, because it's simply historically not true. Whether Bolsonaro says it or whether Dinesh D'Souza says it, it's untrue.
And the first targets of Mussolini and Hitler when they actually achieved power were people on the left.
Exactly. And the genius of Mussolini was, because Hitler was a huge, I talk about their tormented romance extensively in the book, where Hitler was an enormous admirer of Mussolini, because Mussolini did what he couldn't do, because Hitler tried to get into power in 1923, and his putsch failed, and then he got put in prison, and it took him a whole decade to get there. And in the meantime, Mussolini was busy, you know, setting up this autocracy. But one of the things he admired about Mussolini was his ability to kind of domesticate the party and to have his personality cult. And he had a bust of Mussolini on his desk, and other Nazis didn't like this because they thought this was humiliating for Hitler, but he never cared. So I talk about how the tables then got turned, and Hitler ended up decidedly the master of Mussolini.
Well, the book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, and we're talking with its author, Ruth Ben-Ghiat. Ruth is a professor at New York University. She's an historian, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. You remind us in your book, and I think this is really important, that it took a long time for both Mussolini and Hitler to come to power. They formed their political parties in 1921. Their political power really didn't arrive until later, Mussolini first and then Hitler later. But these are not movements that spring up quickly. Would that be accurate to say?
Yes, and I also, Mussolini gets eclipsed by Hitler, and there are good reasons for that. But the way he actually got to power is more relevant for the way that authoritarianism works today, because Mussolini became prime minister in 1922. He was invited by the king to come in to kind of soothe this unrest that he, in part, had started with his squadrist violence. And he serves as a prime minister in a democracy for 3 years. And during that time, he chips away at the press, at the opposition parties. He uses violence against them. And then in 1925, he declares dictatorship to get out of a special investigation that was targeting him. And he was going to be arrested because he'd been named for ordering a political opponent killed. So he actually, the world's first dictatorship was formed as an attempt to shut down a special investigation and avoid jail. And this is very symptomatic with how authoritarians today, like Putin, the whole structure of governance and policing is also designed to make sure that they are immune from prosecution and they can't be removed from power. And sadly, during the time I wrote this book, both Putin and Orban have consolidated their power. Putin had the Russian constitution amended so he could stay in power until 2036, and Orban now rules by decree.
Hmm. We talked earlier about propaganda and virility, this projection of hypermasculinity is some of the tools used by these strongmen. But what's your best sense about why people are susceptible to these fascist messages? Why do people, you know, believe these folks? Because you've got 50% of the country that see President Trump as a used car salesman, kind of a carnival barker. They see through him. And then you've got, 43 or 45% of the country that trusts him and his every word.
Part of it is the conditions in which they find favor is when people are very anxious about change. It could be worries about demographic change and, other races and groups and getting power, kind of social emancipation in general that they don't approve of, they can't accept. It's sometimes a time when they're looking for heroes. And then all of these men who've been successful, these rulers, they are very, very skilled at media. They're very skilled at presenting themselves as whatever people need them to be. So Trump was perfect. He's an actor. He's a reality TV star. He's always presented himself as something he's not. When he was young and he didn't have any money yet, he was going around in a limo. So he's always been very skilled at psychological warfare to be what people need him to be. And that is a theme I found with every single ruler, and that's part of their charm. And then as soon as they get to power, they're also using violence and intimidation. They're buying people off through corruption, and then we have the tools of rule that they use to stay there. But I'd like to say that Trump, it's easy to talk about him as a failure, and he just golfs all the time, and he's very weak. But I think that's a little short-sighted because he has constructed a personality cult that is incredibly successful, which is why over 70 million people voted for him despite...
Civil authority has issued required monthly tests for the following counties or areas: Rhode Island, Bristol, Kent, Newport, Providence, Washington, Rhode Island, at 10:49 a.m. on November 12th, 2020, effective until 11:49 a.m. This is a test. This station is participating in a coordinated monthly test of the Rhode Island Operational Area Emergency Alert System. The Rhode Island broadcasters, in cooperation with federal, state, and local authorities, have developed this system to provide immediate warning, information, or instructions. If this had been an actual emergency, the attention signal you just heard would have been followed by official news, information, or instructions. This concludes this test of the emergency alert system.
Supporting illiberal rulers. You know, why they did that, I think the shock and the affront of having Obama in office for 8 years, there have been other situations like that where somebody comes in to undo the legacy of someone who was never supposed to get to office in the first place. And this was also the case in Chile. Although Pinochet came to power over a coup, there was this desire to just completely dismantle everything that Allende, the socialist president, had done. And there's a kind of fury against the legacy of Obama that you see has animated the Trump organization. So I think that the GOP was moving in this direction anyway, and it got galvanized by the changes that happened during the Obama administration.
What's the legacy of these strongmen around the world? I'm thinking, Mussolini had the reputation of getting the trains to run on time. Pinochet had this reputation that he saved Chile from turning into Cuba. But in terms of fixing things, and President Trump famously says, "I can do anything, I can fix anything." What's the reputation of these strongmen now that we've had some historical perspective? Were they able to fix things?
No, in words, and that's why all of them end up. Pinochet was one of the very few who was voted out, partly because of economic mismanagement. We hear about his neoliberal successes, but we don't hear about how, in the early 80s, there were massive bank failures and all the other things that happened. So one of the themes that emerged from writing the book is that while authoritarians like us to believe that the trains run on time, which in Mussolini's Italy, only the trains that catered to tourists ran on time. Everybody else had worse service than ever because they're not interested in public welfare, quite the opposite. And we're still very influenced by the propaganda of these authoritarians themselves in believing that authoritarianism is actually good for business because of stability. Because when you look at economic studies, they're actually very bad for business. And you have not only because they drive so many hardworking people into exile, but they also prey upon business people. Putin has jailed tens of thousands of businessmen, and they plunder their businesses and they steal their assets. And Erdogan has gone after $32 billion worth of businesses. So we have to take this claim that they are good for the economy with a huge grain of salt.
And coronavirus, how you know, like, for instance, in the Philippines, Duterte, or in Brazil, Bolsonaro, how have these strongmen who are existent today, how have they done with coronavirus?
So it's you know, right now we're in a phase all over the world of renewed wave of coronavirus. So in democracies as well, people are back in lockdown, and this is because of human behavior. But what we can say is that leaders like Trump and Bolsonaro made things immeasurably worse because they were denying this inconvenient disease that was going to harm the economy. And in Trump's case, he only was caring about his reelection prospects. So they lost valuable time, both of them, in trying to minimize the virus and in not wanting to develop an adequate, governmental structure. In Trump's case, the demonization of the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is very notable. And the entire anti-science mentality of these autocrats who fear science because it's objective knowledge, right? The slogan the fascists had, Mussolini is always right, that applies to Trump too. And he's staffed his government with these lackeys and flatterers. And as we well know, part of the reason so many people have exited is he can't stand to have anyone tell him the truth. And none of this bodes well for a public health crisis.
Well, we're talking with the author of the brand new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is our guest, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So do we have any evidence that President Trump knows about how these strong men rulers ruled in the past, or does President Trump's inner circle have any connection to these strong men?
So, yeah, people, he is, actually, Trump is very different than all other leaders because he doesn't read. He's not interested in reading. He gets all of this knowledge from television. So he doesn't have a manual, playbook that he's following. He's making it up as he goes along. And all of them have very similar temperaments, which is why they act in similar ways. So there's no master plan. They're just supreme opportunists, and they are ruthless and amoral, and so they don't hesitate to take advantage of chances that more conventional politicians wouldn't want to go there in that way. So this has been a great strength of Trump.
And how many ties, let's say if we looked at the people that surrounded President Trump during his 2016 campaign, how many people that were close to him in 2016 had ties to people like Putin or some of these other leaders that we've been talking about?
Yeah, this was, I hadn't realized until I did the research for the book. Trump is kind of, the people who are around him have a lot of experience with propping up old-school dictators. So you had Roger Stone and Paul Manafort have a lobbying firm. And they not only worked for Mobutu in the Congo, who's in my book, he's one of the world's worst kleptocrats, but they also were hired in 1985 by Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines to oversee his fraudulent election. And so that should give us pause. And then there's Steve Bannon, who isn't as out of the picture as people think, who is an unabashed apologist for Mussolini and fascism and has dedicated his whole life to promoting far-right populism and authoritarians in Europe and everywhere. So, and there are many other examples. There are people who support Trump who are very admiring of Pinochet and want to cut entitlements in a very extreme way and they cite what happened, the neoliberalism of Pinochet, as an example. So there were a lot of people who were around Trump and influenced him who connect to this whole century of strongmen in ways that I had not known about until I did the research for this book, and I found very disturbing.
So what works in pushing back? I mean, if people who are listening right now want a small d democracy, they don't want a dictatorial type leader in office. What's worked to push back these strongmen rulers around the globe?
So it was with great relief that I got to the resistance chapter, because it was an inspiration to see how people organized to push back. And one of the most effective methods has been nonviolent mass protest. People who come together physically. Nowadays, of course, we have digital media, which is a double-edged sword. It helps autocrats, but it also helps people who are protecting democracy. And we can use the word resistance, but I think in our case, it's also democracy protection in pushing back, because a lot of the people who, Trump's method of governing has brought out a whole renaissance of people who are working each in their own way to protect our democracy. So I advise a group called Protect Democracy, which was formed by lawyers and people who used to work in the Department of Justice. And they pursue a legal pushback. So when Trump's administration is always trying to say, oh, Antifa and label protesters as violent terrorists, but this doesn't capture the reality of how people have actually opposed dictators and their equivalents today. And it doesn't capture the breadth of what's going on in our country, where again, people are using bureaucratic means, legal means, as well as going into the street with signs, as well as humor. There's caricatures, there's Saturday Night Live. There's American societies have a kind of a renaissance of consciousness of how fragile our rights are. And this is one long-term effect of Trump.
I know as an academic you don't like to make predictions, but if, as I read in Axios, that President Trump has already told advisors he's thinking about running again for 2024, what do you make of that?
So I had to finish the book in July and put it into the press, and I was trying to write it for any outcome of the election. And one of the last things they say about Trump is, based on this whole history, is never underestimate his tenacity and his willingness to do anything he needs to stay in office.
You got that one right.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, and I will preface this by saying I hate to be right, I've predicted a vast number of things that have happened based on my knowledge of how this has worked before in other places and times, and my close study of Trump. And I'm always wishing that I'm wrong for the good of everyone. So I think that, you know, we can hold dear the fact that this election, every ballot cast was a ballot for democracy protection, and people voted under difficult circumstances. It was hard to vote because the GOP made it difficult to vote in some places. And I think that even as the government is playing this kind of psychological warfare game, doing things like the Trump administration released a budget for February, as though they're going to be there and the election never happened. Or Pompeo, Secretary of State Pompeo said, oh, we're going to have a transition to a second Trump administration. And these are mind games that they're playing with us, but I think we need to remember the great accomplishment that was this election, if you care about democracy.
Well, Ruth, I know a lot of our listeners do care about democracy. Thank you for writing a great book. It's a great overview of the last 100 years and the move in some countries towards fascism. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for coming on WMNF.
Thank you for hosting me.
Thanks, Ruth. The book is Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is the author. She's a professor at NYU in New York City. And this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. I'm going to read some of the emails that have come in the last few minutes before we go to the news. Greg writes from the Washington Post, Trump's unofficial, unorthodox quest for the Nobel Peace Prize has benefited from the help of far-flung foreign allies, including an anti-immigrant Norwegian politician and an Australian law professor best known for pro-monarchy campaigns. So that's an answer to the caller at the top of the program. James writes this, I do believe Uncle Joe should forget this bipartisanship and just everybody get along. It ain't going to happen. Instead, he should come in like Jason Bourne and get stuff done. If not, we will waste 4 years and wind up with Tom Cotton or Don Jr., writes James. James wrote that at 11:27 this morning. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. We've got time for maybe one phone call. Andy sends in the fact check about the Nobel Peace Prize nomination process. Andy, thank you for that. Deborah in Spring Hill writes, Emily Murphy, a Trump appointee, is refusing to sign the letter authorizing the Biden transition to begin. I called her at 844-472-4111, press customer service option, to urge her to sign for a variety of reasons, including the refusal to accept President-elect Biden's victory creates instability and provides for an opening for our enemies. Let's go to Mike, who's calling in from Brandon. Mike, what would you like to say?
Hey, Rob. Vote. It's that simple.
The election's over, Mike.
No, it is not. Oh, you are wrong, my friend.
Okay, what election are you talking about?
I'm talking, obviously, the Senate. Obviously, the Georgia.
Okay, well, our listeners live in Tampa. I think
I know that. Yeah. I understand that. I understand that, Rob. Well, what I'm saying is part of the problem is we fall into this trap that progressives are notoriously bad about. They're incredibly idealistic and whatnot. You know, they screwed themselves when they talked about defunding the police before the election. You do it after elections, not before elections. Right now, if Biden's going to have any possibility of a successful, at least for the next 2 years, we've got to get those seats. And anyone in Florida, if they can give contributions to people that on behalf of those candidates in Georgia, they need to do it in that way.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Mike, thank you. Thank you. Good to hear from you. Yeah, there'll be a lot of discussion about the upcoming Georgia special elections for U.S. Senate on this radio station, and I'll bet there'll be a lot on television, too. If you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Thanks for listening and stay tuned. Coming up next, Janet and Shelley will be here on the Midpoint program. This is 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg. Bill Grace has been our phone producer today. We're going to go up to Washington, D.C. right now and get the latest news from National Public Radio and find out what's happened in the last hour.